Well, turn with me this morning to Genesis chapter 31. Genesis chapter 31, where we are resuming our studies of the scriptural record of the unfolding of God's redemptive plan. In our last study, we continued our look at the saga of Jacob's somewhat tumultuous life, noting how by God's sovereign grace and providence, Jacob was able to amass from Laban's flock of genetically pure white and brown animals a large flock of striped, spotted, and black sheep and goats, which, according to his agreement with Laban, became part of Jacob's own flock. Now, how did that happen? Well, in all fairness, we really don't know, apart from the miraculous. We really don't know how this happened. There have been some attempts to explain this in purely scientific terms. In an internet article that was shared with me from creation.com, the author examined several external factors, such as the kind of wood that Jacob had stripped the bark from and placed it in front of the watering trough. And in that article, the author asks if there was any kind of medicinal property or any kind of inherent property in the wood itself that might have resulted in this change to the fur or the hair of the animals in question. According to the researchers behind this article, this is doubtful. They concluded not only would Jacob have required a lot of material to drug the entire water supply, but the trees themselves are not that special, and there is nothing medicinally special about them. The author goes on saying, had Jacob fed the bark to the animals, that could potentially have an effect. This would more likely be due to the nutritional yield than to any potential medicinal effects. But the Bible says nothing about him feeding the animals any of the bark. Placing the sticks in or near the water source would probably have had no chemical effect either. Thus, one would assume that the stripes Jacob peeled in the bark were not important from a medicinal standpoint, and the stripes had nothing to do with the reproduction in these animals. In the final analysis, this article concludes by saying, we simply don't have enough details. There are many possible explanations behind the heredity of wool color in Jacob's sheep. We don't exactly know which genes play a role because this breeding program happened several thousand years ago. Researchers are only now beginning to understand the genetics behind wool color in sheep and goats. In the case that wool color is caused by more than one gene, we don't even know how tightly linked they were to one another. Ever since then, he says, the genes could also have undergone mutations or been shuffled around or separated from one another. The Bible also isn't clear enough in this passage for us to draw hard and fast conclusions. Now, the real takeaway from this passage is not whether the animals in Jacob's care were able to be genetically modified through chemical means, through nutritional means, through using certain types of wood, any of that. At the end of the day, Jacob prospered and Laban suffered because God had sovereignly ordained it to be so. Amen? I mean, that's the takeaway. We can speculate, we can entertain all kinds of theories and conjectures, but at the end of the day, Jacob's flock produced the kind of sheep that God intended for it to produce so that Jacob would thrive and Laban would learn a lesson. Now, let's go ahead and read beginning at verse 1 of chapter 31, and I think this will all become a little bit clearer. Beginning at verse 1, we read, "Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father he has made all his wealth." Now, was that true? No. No. Jacob had not done anything wrong. Jacob had made a deal, he had an agreement, a covenant with Laban, and the terms were clearly established before any future generations of sheep or goats were ever born. Jacob had done nothing wrong. He played by the rules. The only advantage he had was that he trusted in a sovereign God to handle all the details. Now, had Jacob cheated Laban through some kind of genetic sorcery, as some insist, Laban's sons would have had a legitimate claim, but he didn't. Now, how do we know? We'll keep reading. Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field and said to them, "I see your father's attitude, that it is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me." Now, once again, we have a nod to the sovereignty of God here, don't we? In spite of Laban's constant adjustment of the terms of the deal that they had made, Jacob acknowledges that God didn't allow Laban to hurt him, either financially or otherwise. Now, how had Laban changed the deal on Jacob these 10 times over the course of his serving him? Well, keep reading at verse 8. Jacob says, "If he spoke thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth speckled. And if he spoke thus, the striped shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth striped. Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me." I think that's pretty comical. You know, Laban's trying everything he can to thwart the sovereign plan of God. Laban is trying everything he can to preserve his own wealth, to preserve his own livestock. And so he changes the rules every step of the way. He says, "Okay, from now on, you're going to get only the speckled." And all of the sheep turn out to be speckled. "Oh, now wait a minute. No, that's not what I meant. What I meant was striped. From now on, all you're going to get is the striped." And at that point, all of the sheep become striped. You see how God's working here? God's saying, Laban, you're not going to do this. And this is what Jacob means when he says that God protected him from any harm coming from Laban. God is supernaturally and sovereignly making sure that Laban suffers and that Jacob thrives. Now, note very carefully that Jacob doesn't take any credit. This is important too, because had Jacob done something based upon his genius in the area of animal husbandry, based upon things that he had learned, things that he knew, tricks that he had up his sleeve, had he done anything that would have resulted in the successful breeding of these sheep to his own benefit, he would have said that. He would have probably given God partial credit, but he would have said something akin to, "Well, you know, it was God's sovereign grace and my ingenuity that caused this to take place." He doesn't do that. Jacob acknowledges that it was God and God alone who could do what he did to prosper Jacob. And to make sure that Jacob understood this, keep reading at verse 10. The Lord appears to him in another dream. Now, why this is here and not back in the previous account, we'll never know. I think it's probably one of those things to keep us in suspense till we get here. But this is one of those instances where if you take a verse or a passage out of context and don't read either what's written before or what's written afterwards, you might be guilty of making a whole lot of useless conjecture. We did that last week, as a matter of fact, not formally, but we all kind of spoke about how this happened and why this happened. Well, if we just kept reading, God tells us how this happened. Verse 10, "And it came about at the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am.' He said, 'Lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. According to Kyle and Dielich, one of the premier Old Testament commentaries, this dream was, quote, a divine intimation to Jacob that his immense wealth was not to be ascribed to the success of his own stratagem, but to the blessing of God. And just so there's no confusion in Jacob's mind about who's addressing him here, this angel of God, obviously a theophany or pre-incarnate visitation of the second person of the Trinity, this angel of God says to Jacob, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. Now stop there. Having received permission from the Lord himself to return to his own land, Jacob would have been relieved. You can only imagine. I mean, he's served Laban now, as we'll discover in just a moment, for 20 years. 7 years for the hand of Rachel. It was supposed to end there. Laban slips in Leah into the deal, cost him another 7 years. That's 14 years. And then there's the 6 years that he watched Laban's flocks. So 20 years. So when he finally gets word from the Lord himself, okay, you can return to your homeland, he would have been overjoyed. Who wouldn't be? Problem with that, though, is he's no longer alone. He had others to consider, namely Rachel, Leah. And what was their reaction to the news that they'd be leaving? You would think they might be a little saddened, right? You'd think that they might be a little hesitant to leave the home that they had known their entire lives. Was that the case? No. In fact, if understood correctly, if Rachel and Leah never agreed on anything else in their troubled relationship, they were in full support of this move. Listen to their reasoning in verses 14 to 16. Rachel and Leah said to him, "Do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us and has also entirely consumed our purchase price." Rachel and Leah knew that in Laban's eyes, and this would have been a fairly significant blow to their psychological well-being. They knew that in Laban's eyes, they were little more than property. They were used as pawns. They had been used as bargaining chips for Laban to get what Laban wanted. Laban apparently didn't really care for Rachel and Leah. He saw them as a means to an end. He saw them as a way to get wealth from Jacob, who he knew to be the son of Isaac and Rebekah, who he knew had inherited much of Abraham's fortune. So Rachel and Leah were all the more willing to take this journey with Jacob. They go on saying, "Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you." In other words, God has said move, let's move. And don't feel guilty about it either. Because everything that we got by way of my father is ours legitimately, because God has blessed us accordingly. Rachel and Leah are saying, in effect, we disagree with our brothers. Remember the brothers' reaction? They were angry. They couldn't make sense out of it. They couldn't believe that Jacob would have the audacity to take what was their father's. They didn't understand the agreement. They didn't understand God's sovereign providence. They didn't understand anything about the deal. All they saw was that their own fortunes were being lessened. Like father, like sons, obviously. They're saying, in fact, it was our father who cheated you. So whatever God told you to do, do it. Verse 17, then Jacob arose And he put his children and wives upon camels. And he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered, his acquired livestock which he had gathered in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. So Jacob and his family are finally on their way back to Canaan. They'll no longer have to have any further dealings with this selfish, crafty, and cunning Laban. Or would they? Verse 19. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. So why would Rachel do something like stealing the household idols that belong to Laban? It wasn't like she was going to sell them. It wasn't like they needed the money. They could have been, like many of the idols of the period. They were simply beautiful, and Rachel might have considered them to be fairly nice little tchotchkes to put above the fireplace or something of that sort. People did collect idols and relics and things like that without ever intending to worship them. Many of them were beautiful. Many of them were made out of the finest metals and jewels and things like that. So she could have just wanted to use them in a decorative sense. It wasn't that she wanted Laban to follow them because she was going to miss her father and wanted to see him one final time. Was it perhaps because she was angry with her father and saw this as a way of getting back at him? Was it because she wanted him to stop worshiping idols? So she took his idols. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense because you can pick up idols anywhere. Idol manufacture was very prominent during this time. And so that's doubtful as well. Maybe Rachel wanted the idols for sentimental reasons. In other words, these idols would serve as kind of an endearing reminder of growing up in her father's home where he led them in worship. Albert Barnes comments here saying, Rachel had a lingering attachment to these objects of her family's superstitious reverence and secretly carried them away as relics of a home she was to visit no more and as sources of safety to herself against the perils of her flight. Now, let me caution you here. This is a good example of where commentaries can be dangerous, right? I mean, I know a lot of people, they read the scriptures and they, once they feel satisfied that they've dissected the scriptures themselves, all well and good, and then they go read a commentary and the commentary changes their mind relative to certain things. Don't be so quick to allow that to happen. Why? Because Albert Barnes, as respected as he is as a commentator, Albert Barnes has committed the fallacy of conjecture here. How do I know that? I know that because we're not told. We don't know why she took them. So to ascribe some sentimental purpose for her taking these idols is just pure conjecture. I mean, it makes sense. It's possible. But he should have said something akin to, among other possibilities, it could be that, and then stated his case. Commentators don't often do that. A lot of times they'll just state it as if it's fact. And you need to be very careful when you're reading commentaries, not to just believe, you know, there's also another logical fallacy going on there, which is called appeal to authority. You know, you read a commentary by Calvin or Luther or Lenski, and you're like, well, you know, he's Calvin, I'm not. He's Lenski, I'm not. And so he must be right. No, don't be so quick to do that. And if those men were alive today, they'd tell you the same thing. So again, just let that be an example in how to properly study the scriptures. Perhaps Rachel was herself still an idol worshiper. That could be true as well. Some commentators suggest that Rachel took the idols so that the idols wouldn't tell Laban where they had gone. Hey, they believed some really far out things back then, right? So why did she do it? We really have no idea. But let me make two really important observations in all of this. First, it's important to understand there is abundant historical evidence to suggest that the teraphim, and that's the name given to any of these small trinkets, these small sculptures, these small objects that were designed to promote the worship of any number of deities. There's a lot of historical evidence to suggest that these were also used to aid the earliest believers in Ha Elohim, the one true God, in their worship of the one true God. Understand, this predates God's giving of the law at Sinai. This predates any sort of codified law at all among God's followers. And so it only stood to reason that even those who followed Ha Elohim, this one true God of Abraham and Isaac and now Jacob, many of them used these little things as aid because that's what they were accustomed to. And I say that because it's important to understand that Laban himself might have actually been following the one true God, just wrongly, doing it in a way that would later be prohibited. I firmly believe that these are the times spoken of in Acts 17 as the times of ignorance that God overlooked, or in the Hebrew, he winked at them. When man is ignorant of God's standards, when man is ignorant, completely ignorant of God's expectations, when he's ignorant concerning the regulative principle of worship, then there is a sense in which God does not hold him culpable for the mistakes that he makes in worship. And I think that's very important because rather than throwing Laban under the bus and everybody associated with him, I think it's important that we understand that they might have been worshiping the right God, just in all the wrong ways. So that's one possibility. Secondly, let's be clear on this one thing. It doesn't really matter why Rachel took the teraphim from her father. Theft is always a sin. It doesn't even matter if she had the noblest of intentions in wanting to preserve her father from future idol worship. She stole from her father. Children, hear me well, because if you like something you see, even if you think you need it or deserve it, even if you think the person who owns it will not mind if you take it, it's not yours. Theft is always wrong. Always, always, always. It's never okay. Well, I'm not going to spend a lot of time addressing the charge of Jacob's deception of Laban by his not telling him that they were leaving, except to say that this was also a sin. This was deception. Well, you might be asking, well, he did it for his own protection. He did it because he feared that Rachel and Leah's brothers might come after him. He did it because he feared Laban. And Laban might manufacture another reason to keep him there. It still doesn't remove the fact that it's a sin. How do we know it's a sin? It's a sin because the Bible tells us that it was a deception. Now, what sin might that fall under? Well, I could name several, but the chief among them would be honoring your mother and your father. Right? Jacob, Rachel, and Leah are planning to leave without telling Rachel and Leah's father and the grandfather of their children. That's cruel. I don't care who he is. It was not necessary, especially if you trust in a sovereign God who has just told you to leave. How much do you really trust him when you resort to deception to try to sneak out under the cover of darkness and not tell Laban where you're going? And it's not like Laban didn't know. I mean, didn't Laban not know where Isaac's home was? He did. He did. That's where Rebecca was. So again, not going to spend a lot of time on that, but it was still wrong for Jacob to not give Laban any indication that he was leaving with Laban's daughters and grandchildren. So how did Laban react? Verse 22. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled. Okay, now stop there. This tells us something about Laban himself as well. Laban was obviously not a micromanager. Laban was not as oppressive as we might think because, well, of course, he could have been gone somewhere. We don't know. But I tend to believe that the reason it was 3 days before he even realized that they were gone was because he had developed a trust for Jacob. And why not? Jacob was the quintessential employee. Jacob was very good at following orders. Jacob was very good at making changes along the way, even if they suited Laban. And so there had been a trust built up, but it was 3 days before Laban found out that Jacob had fled. And then what did he do? He took his kinsman with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. Now, don't miss that little point. Jacob's been gone 3 days, but Laban pursues him a distance of 7 days' journey before he overtakes him in the hill country of Gilead. What does that tell you about the speed, the haste that Jacob's making? Jacob's motoring. Jacob is on the move. Jacob is so ready to get home. Jacob is so ready to be free from Laban's oppressive rule. He's practically running with his family. Took 7 days to catch up with it. And then God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob, either good or bad." Uh-oh. Then what happened? Well, Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with timbrel and lyre, and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob.'" Well, first of all, do you really think that Laban would have thrown a going away party for him? Probably not. But again, Laban's trying to save face here. Laban is trying to say, I would have kissed all of you goodbye and give you a hug around the neck and a peck on the cheek, and there would have been music and food and all of that. Well, Jacob had no reason to believe that. He had no reason to believe that. I mean, you don't say something like that and then immediately follow it up with, "It's in my power to do you harm." Okay, bring back the other Laban. You know, I like the guy who was just talking. Now you're talking about doing me harm, and you would do me harm if God had not told you to not do that. Now notice as well how Laban refers to God here as the God of your father and not as his own personal God. Now, this is a fairly strong indication that Laban might not have been a worshiper of the one true God. Otherwise, he would have said, your God and mine, or my Lord appeared to me, or the Lord appeared to me. But no, he says, the God of your father appeared to me. In fact, Laban goes on to suggest that this was perhaps one of the reasons Jacob had left. He says, now you've indeed gone away because you long greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my idols? No. Why did you steal my gods? Very strong in the original language. This indicates that he thought them to be gods. Why did you steal my gods? And then Jacob replied to Laban, because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. And then Jacob says something that, were it not for the grace of God, could be chalked up in history as one of the most bizarre and spectacular blunders ever made. Almost right up there with David, right? David being told that there was a man doing this, that, and the other thing, horrible things, and David says, yeah, he should die. And what did the priest say to him? I'm talking about you, right? What does Jacob say? He says, the one with whom you find your God shall not live. Rut-row. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. You know, there's so many applications we could make here. First of all, don't speak out of turn. Don't speak before you know all the facts. Second of all, husbands, wives, don't have any secrets between the two of you. Right? They should have talked about this. I'm not sure what Jacob would have done, knowing Jacob and his honorable personality. He probably would have turned around and taken them back. Instead, he put his wife's own life in danger. And how do we know that? Well, once again, we can see God's preservation of Jacob in spite of Rachel's sin. How so? Read on. So Laban went into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two maids, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Bum, bum, bum. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle. And she sat on them. And Laban felt through all the tent, but did not find them. She said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household idols. And again, it was a lie that actually saved Jacob's life. So let me ask you kids again, does that make lying acceptable? No. No. You know, I'm often asked that question, is lying ever acceptable? Well, let me just say this, God might overlook lies. God might bless in spite of our lies. But lying is never acceptable. You know, the primary thing that people like to throw up in my face when I say that is, well, what about the Jews during the Holocaust? If you were a Christian family harboring Jews and the Gestapo came and knocked on the door and asked you point blank, are you harboring Jews in your home? Were you free to lie? No. You're not free to lie. Did God overlook many of those lies? Yes. Did it turn out for the favor of those being hidden? Yes. But you can't conflate the two things. It doesn't mean that lying is ever okay. It just means that our God is a merciful God. That our God is a long-suffering God. that our God often overlooks the sins that we do commit to bring about His divine purpose. And it all goes back to trust, doesn't it? If we truly trusted in a sovereign God, you know, we trust in Star Wars more than we trust in a sovereign God. How do I know? You know, when the stormtroopers are, they have this sort of, they're looking for Luke and Leia and they're looking for all these different things and what is the Jedi mind trick? Right? These are not the ones you're looking for. And the stormtrooper's like, these are not the ones we're looking for, right? Folks, that's Hollywood, but did you know that a full reliance upon God could result in the same kind of miracle? To where they knock on the door, are you harboring any Jewish people in here? We are. Okay, have a good day. Right? Again, we need not conflate the two things. Lying is never acceptable. Lying is a sin. Now, the moment we start making certain sins acceptable because they cause things to turn out better, then where does that end? It doesn't. It never ends. You'll turn into somebody who justifies every sin you commit in some way because it works out for good. Better to trust in God and tell the truth than it is to rely on lies. Now again, God's will is going to work itself out no matter what. We need to have faith and confidence in that fact. Well, then Jacob. See, you got to read the scriptures with just a little bit of, not humor, but you got to read between the lines. What do you think Jacob was doing when he saw that Laban wasn't finding anything? You think he was probably smug? Had that little grin on his face, that little smirk? Maybe even said something like, didn't find anything, did you? Didn't think you would, because we didn't take anything. Nanny, nanny, boo-boo. Right? So you've got to feel that Jacob, still blissfully unaware of Rachel's thievery, and probably emboldened by the fact that Laban hadn't found anything, he became angry. And he contended with Laban, Moses says. And Jacob said to Laban, what is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn of beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was by day, the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and my fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I've served you 14 years for your 2 daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night. Jacob was correct, wasn't he? Much like Job. Jacob had endured injustice after injustice time and time again. Laban had it out for him, and if not for God's sovereign protection and provision, Laban would have taken full advantage of Jacob, leaving him with nothing. Had Laban not received that vision or that dream to not harm Jacob, you bet your bottom dollar that Jacob, Rachel, Leah, and the grandkids would have been sitting in the middle of that place with nothing. But I think equally important is the fact that Laban also learned a very important lesson from God that day. And again, it doesn't matter that Rachel was sitting on these idols, hiding them from her father. That's a sin. We've already established that. They should have been honest and forthright. At least being his daughter, if there was any love at all for her, he might have just let them go. Again, doubtful, but what did Laban learn? Well, Laban learned that despite his best efforts, and despite how deceptive everybody had been in this case, Laban learned that he would never be able to thwart the sovereign plan of the thrice holy God. He had tried and tried and tried to thwart God's plan, and it didn't happen. And to ratify or to codify this new realization that Laban had, we read this, beginning at verse 43. Then Laban replied to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne?" Now stop. Is this a heartfelt soliloquy from a man who is deeply disturbed over what he has done? Is this something that, you know, Laban's having second thoughts and now you're seeing the sweeter side of Laban? No. This is a man who suddenly realizes that he's fighting against God. He suddenly realizes that there are things in play here that he cannot possibly even wrap his brain around, much less stand in the way of. So what does he do? He's trying to save face again. You know, this is what a man does who's desperate and realizes there's no way out. He says, well, forget the fact that this, all of this is mine, which it's not. But what can I do? So come now, he says. Let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Yegar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore it was named Galeed and Mizpah. For he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. You've seen the little Mizpah necklaces that besties give each other, right? If you knew the context of where that comes from, you probably wouldn't be so quick to rush off to James Avery and get one of these, right? You've seen them. You give one half to your bestie when they're moving off to college, and you keep one half for yourself. And it's a quote directly from this passage. May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. Did he mean that? No. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm. It's a battle line. It's a line in the sand. Lest you think that there's all kinds of good, you know, feel-good stuff going on here. No, this is a man defeated by a sovereign God who's saying, I still have some control here. Let's agree. I won't hurt you if you don't hurt me. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal, and they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. So Jacob, Rachel, Leah, and all their children lived happily ever after, right? They swooped down into the land of Canaan and they enjoyed a life of abundance and prosperity till all of them died peaceful deaths. And that, no. No. As a matter of fact, Jacob, which he kind of suspected, but not really, Jacob jumping right out of the pan into the fire. And that fire's name is Esau. You know, I don't know whether Jacob forgot. I don't know if he thought enough time had elapsed between the time he left Canaan and went to Haran. Now maybe Esau, maybe he's dead. Maybe he moved on. I'm going to take my chances. But as we'll see, Lord willing, in our next study, beginning in chapter 32, things didn't go so swimmingly for Jacob at this point. So again, more on that when we get there.